On June 15th, 1985, a body was found in San Francisco, in the South of Market area, often abbreviated as the SoMa District. The body of a young homeless man was found wedged underneath the tractor trailer of a semi-truck. The victim, a Caucasian man of slight build, stood around 5 feet 5 inches tall and weighed around 130 pounds. He had been wrapped inside a blanket before being left in the streets. Alone, this would already be creepy, if not downright terrifying. But to make matters worse, the victim had been sadistically tortured and killed. When the discovery was announced in the press, the relatively local Santa Ana Orange County Register declared, quote, "Police say the man was bled to death and that he was butchered in ritualistic fashion in a type of devil worship ceremony." Police reports would note the following injuries to the body of the deceased. His hands had been bound behind his back with guitar string. Several burn marks were noted on his neck. Candle wax had been poured into his right eye. An upside-down pentagram had been carved into his chest. His chest and neck had been slashed multiple times with a knife. His genitals had been mutilated, and his lower lip had been cut open. It would be noted, in following reports, that his lip had been purposefully split in order for the responsible party to consume the victim's blood. But it's really hard to say whether or not that was true, or just a sign of the Times reporting, which was heavily steeped in satanic panic and fear of the occult. This is the story of San Francisco's John Doe number 60. Roughly 2 years passed, in which the investigation to determine what had happened to John Doe number 60 had struggled through a series of starts and stops. Following the discovery of John Doe's body in June of 1985, the trail went cold. That is, until a man named Maurice Bork fell into the sights of law enforcement. In the months after the discovery of John Doe, Bork had been accused of kidnapping and robbery. The suspect, who survived, mind you, claimed that Bork had scratched a pentagram into their chest during the commission of this kidnapping, a violent crime made all the more horrific due to the satanic imagery it conjures up. Maurice Bork already had a less than stellar reputation. He was a Canadian citizen who had prior arrest, and who had escaped from prison up in Canada and illegally immigrated to the United States in the early 1980s. For some time, he had been living in the Bay Area, coasting by and living under fake identities. He was also known to play guitar. Bork was eventually convicted for the kidnapping and robbery charges, but seemed to be growing restless behind bars. In 1987, roughly 1 year after his conviction, Bork contacted law enforcement to let them know that he had information about an unsolved crime. When they asked for more details, he said that he knew what had happened to John Doe number 60, and more importantly, he knew who was responsible. His ex-lover, a man named Clifford St. Joseph. Clifford St. Joseph was an openly gay man living in San Francisco who was working as a waiter to pay the bills. Clifford had grown up with a single mother, and the relationship between the two was tense, to say the least. Clifford decided to have himself emancipated at the age of 14, and he subsisted for a brief period of time by selling newspapers. Eventually, he became a waiter, which turned out to be a pretty good gig for him. Despite seeming to move on to bigger and better things, Clifford did have a dark side. He had a previous misdemeanor conviction for check fraud, as well as a statutory rape charge hanging over his head. When Clifford was 17, he had had sex with a 15-year-old, which resulted in him getting charged and spending some time in a juvenile prison. With that being said, other than the misdemeanor check fraud case from a few years later, Clifford had no real marks on his criminal record. He lived a relatively quiet life, worked as a waiter, and had a constantly revolving group of friends. Clifford St. Joseph prided himself on opening up his home for misfits and runaways, stating that he tried to create the kind of environment that he would have appreciated as a struggling youth. In the process of opening up his home, however, he opened it up to all kinds, including the homeless. This included vagabonds like Maurice Bork, whom he met and befriended just weeks before the death of the man police would later refer to as John Doe number 60. At the time, Bork was living off of the grid, having escaped from a Canadian prison and trying to gain employment in the Bay Area. St. Joseph helped arrange for him to get a fake ID and allowed him to stay at his apartment for a brief period of time. During that brief period, the two became lovers. There's no telling what kind of relationship the two had together, but it seems to have ended at some point. Over the next 2 years, Clifford St. Joseph would continue on his regular everyday life, while Maurice Bork had since been arrested, charged, and convicted for kidnapping and robbery. This leads us to the fateful phone call, where Bork decided to turn in his former roommate and lover. He claimed that St. Joseph, now middle-aged and living with a roommate, had tortured and killed John Doe, and that he, Maurice Bork, had helped dispose of the victim's body and cover up the crime. This immediately piqued the interest of investigators, who saw this as a possibility to close out an old case file of theirs. They immediately got the gears moving on the stalled investigation and began looking into Clifford St. Joseph. Clifford St. Joseph was arrested at his home in June of 1987, charged with sodomy, false imprisonment, and murder. You see, not only was he being charged with the murder of the unidentified man found 2 years prior, he was also being tried along with a separate case from just earlier that year, in 1987. He was suspected of arranging the kidnapping of a 21-year-old homeless sex worker, and then torturing and gang-raping him along with a group of conspirators. One of the alleged co-conspirators was none other than former roommate and lover Maurice Bork. The others included men in their social circle, such as a man named Edward Spella, as well as St. Joseph's most recent roommate. I know this may sound a bit confusing, because stuff like this usually doesn't happen. It's not often that multiple cases get thrown together in a metaphorical crockpot of allegations. Usually, both cases would be tried separately, but the prosecution argued that they should be tried together, to establish a narrative, if you will. The most recent season of Serial has gone into cases like this, where prosecutors will throw everything but the kitchen sink at the defendant, in order to make them look guilty prior to any court proceedings, thus increasing the likelihood that they fold and accept a plea deal, easing the burden of the court and the justice system. By merging the cases together, the prosecutor was hoping to establish that the young victim, who had been allegedly kidnapped and gang-raped, was set to be the next victim of Clifford St. Joseph and his associates. Thus, by mere association, establishing them as members of some kind of satanic cult before the trial even started. Per usual, the prosecution had its way. The trials were set to be merged, and Clifford St. Joseph was set to be tried for all of his charges in one trial, facing allegations from a spurned ex-lover and a victim whose testimony police had been sitting on for months before arresting St. Joseph. St. Joseph's defense attorney, Harriet Ross, later stated that the merging of both cases into one proceeding dashed their hopes before the trial was even underway. Quote, "The joinder of the rape and murder was the damning action. It was incredibly prejudicial. I will never believe otherwise. Each one tried alone. There was a good case for an acquittal or a lesser charge. But together, they were so glaringly horrible that the jury had to be emotionally reacting to the facts." Not surprisingly, the trial against Clifford St. Joseph became an incredibly dramatic affair. The witnesses called by the state became a cavalcade of convicts, drug addicts, and personalities that the prosecution would normally never try to pin a case on. These witnesses included Maurice Bork, an alleged co-conspirator, who was currently serving a sentence for armed robbery and kidnapping, and who had been accused by his victim of torture. Another witness and co-conspirator, named Edward Spella, Ed for short, had his credibility called into question when it was learned that he had told an investigator that he had held sexual relationships with not only Elton John and Liberace, but that he had been enlisted in a plot to assassinate Ronald Reagan. Then there was William McRae, a jailhouse informant who provided some of the most salacious allegations regarding Clifford St. Joseph. He had shared a jail cell with St. Joseph and claimed that the other man spoke loudly and often about Satanism, the occult, and a variety of odd rituals. Of course, his testimony was questioned by the defense when it was learned that he had likely learned all of this by going through St. Joseph's court documents in their shared cell. to which McRae responded by telling the court that he had personally held the binder containing the documents, but had never looked inside. So it was all good, right? Then, it was also learned that soon after providing a statement to police, William McRae had been released from custody. Of course, both the prosecution and McRae denied any funny business, and McRae stuck to his original statement. Outside of this witness testimony, the case against Clifford St. Joseph was very light. The only physical evidence linking him to the crime was a drop of blood found near his apartment bedroom and a small blood stain on a blanket, both of which matched the type of blood possessed by the deceased and were found in a thorough luminol search of his home. Other than that, though, there was no more physical evidence. No real specifics on how or why Clifford St. Joseph had killed the younger John Doe, just a reliance on the jury's fear of his alleged satanic cult. During their final statements, the prosecutor described the entire trial as a, quote, voyage into an underworld we don't want to admit exists in our society. Unable to convince the jury of his innocence, Clifford St. Joseph was convicted on all three charges levied against him. Following his sentencing, which gave him 34 years to life in a state prison, Judge Alfred G. Chantelli stated that St. Joseph's crimes would, quote, astonish the imagination of Edgar Allan Poe or the Marquis de Sade. Clifford St. Joseph was sent to serve his sentence in Folsom State Prison, where he would serve out the entire sentence, all the way maintaining his innocence. Just months after his conviction, the case of Clifford St. Joseph was included in a TV special that many true crime junkies like myself are already familiar with. Geraldo Rivera, the famous TV personality that is known primarily for his mustache and his disappointing unveiling of Al Capone's safe, hosted a daytime talk show for around a decade. Despite Geraldo's attempts to be known as a serious, hard-hitting journalist, the show became most well-known as the predecessor to other shows like Jerry Springer and The Maury Povich Show. In one of his episodes, Geraldo did an exposé about what he believed was an epidemic of satanic cults sweeping across the nation. Included was a snippet regarding the recent conviction of Clifford St. Joseph, and the crimes he had been convicted for. In it, you hear from not only the investigators that built the case against St. Joseph, but also Ed Spella, the alleged co-conspirator and witness, whose testimony helped get St. Joseph convicted, but was facing no real charges of his own.
Hail Satan. Hail a belief system that exalts sadistic murder, torture, ritualistic suicide, and racial purity.
This has historically been a sacred day, a day of purification, a day of hell and fury. We mourn not its victims, we honor its victors. In closing, I would remind those here that murder is the predator's prerogative, and there is no birth without blood.
Berkowitz, Lucas, Ramirez, and Manson are the all-stars in the halls of infamy. But the vast majority of these ritual murders are not the work of the celebrated psychopaths. There are literally hundreds of cases most of us have never heard of. Like this satanic murder in Denver, Colorado, where the victim was handcuffed, chained, and slaughtered. Authorities claim that before he died, the victim participated in drinking his own blood. Or this diabolical example in the city by the bay.
Here in a rundown San Francisco neighborhood far from the tourist attractions and the Golden Gate Bridge, a satanic cult committed crimes of incredible brutality. This is the story of that cult and of its leader, a devil-worshipping murderer named Clifford St. Joseph.
The body was tucked underneath the front wheels on the curb side, wrapped in yellow blankets and tied with a guitar string.
What was the condition of the body when you found it?
It had a number of unusual wounds on it. One of the most unusual things was a design carved into the chest of the individual. And once we examined it more closely, it was an upside-down pentagram.
The devil's pentagram, the inverted five-pointed star found on the unidentified corpse of St. Joseph's victim, is apparently the principal signature of Satanists. Like a recurring nightmare, it shows up at crime scenes and in their graffiti everywhere. At St. Joseph's apartment, where this grisly murder was committed, I talked to Ed, a fringe member of the cult, and the state star witness.
What was going on in this apartment?
They asked me if I had ever thought about killing somebody just to watch them die. And they asked me if I would like to join a satanic cult.
Ritual crime was apparently a regular occurrence at this apartment. In this case of torture and murder, the victim has never been identified. For purposes of this case, he was called John Doe number 60.
The first cut would be to the lips that sealed the person's mouth for all eternity. They also poured wax, I guess, in the eyes, and that sealed their eyes for all eternity.
They did much more to John Doe number 60, but we'll spare you the details. Caught and convicted of murder, kidnapping, and ritual abuse, St. Joseph and another cult member are currently serving long prison sentences. Ed remains free, although he claims only to have been a reluctant participant in the murder of John Doe 60. He does admit bringing a teenager here to be chained up and ritualistically abused.
How can you say you have no guilt when you bring a 17-year-old kid in here, you help shackle him to a radiator, and then participate in his torture and sexual abuse?
Well, I never participated in torture, and no torture was allowed of him.
You were having sex with a kid who's chained up. What are you talking about?
Well, Ricky, first of all, likes that type of sex.
What was going on here is a nightmare.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is a nightmare.
Are there devil worshippers? Are there murderers involved in this particular case still at large?
In this particular case, yes, we do know of, we have one person identified, one man, other man identified, who was present during this particular homicide.
Do you think that this ritualistic stuff is spreading?
It's all over the United States and probably all over the world, because it's just something that people are experimenting with now.
Clifford St. Joseph tried, multiple times, unsuccessfully, to appeal his convictions. In the early 2000s, when DNA testing had become much more widespread, St. Joseph asked for it to be used to help clear him. As far as I can tell, that never happened, with the DA at the time having shown reticence in allowing that to move forward. By now, most of the witnesses that testified against St. Joseph have passed away. Others, like Maurice Bourque, remain locked up behind bars, guilty for a multitude of other crimes. Some even believe that Bourque himself might have been the responsible party. After all, it was he who had a prior conviction for kidnapping and robbery, and who was an escaped prisoner from Canada. It was also he who scratched a pentagram into the torso of a victim, played guitar, and is the only person to confess knowing explicit details about the crime itself. When the victim was horribly tortured with a sharp weapon, had his hands bound with guitar string, and is tied to an individual in such a way, it seems suspicious that that person would not become the primary suspect. Some online commenters have theorized that Bourque only confessed to the crime believing, at the time, that it would lessen his sentence. Some believe that this case, one of the few in America to convict someone for alleged satanic cult activities, was a primary example of satanic panic. Not only was the accused convicted on very shaky grounds, but he was also openly gay, which many believe fed right into the fears of more conservative-minded jurors, God-fearing men and women that perhaps weren't as open-minded as they should have been. Regardless of Clifford St. Joseph's innocence or guilt, it remains odd that, in a case built around a cult sacrifice of sorts, no other members of said cult were ever charged, convicted, or even named by law enforcement. If Clifford St. Joseph was in a cult, then it seems to be a cult of one, in which case it's not much of a cult, then is it? Lost in all of this drama, surrounding allegations of cults, human sacrifice, and satanic rituals, remains the horrible truth. A young man fell prey to horrible violence, suffering significantly in his final hours. He was then abandoned on a San Francisco street, where his name joined the countless nameless thousands that haunt our cities. The identity of San Francisco's John Doe number 60 remains unknown, and his story remains unresolved. Thank you for listening to this episode of Unresolved. As you could tell, this was not a full-length episode. During my research for the prior episode, Leroy Carter Jr., I stumbled upon this story and I just found it so fascinating. I thought about including this in the theory section of the last episode, but knew that it would not fit. I seriously doubt there is any connection between the stories, but figured that I could just try to tell the story as best as I can, with what little resources I could actually find. Hope it turned out. If you would like to stay in touch with me or the podcast, you can just Google it. Type in Unresolved Podcast and it should pop up on any platform. As you can tell, I'm trying to keep this one brief because Red Dead Redemption 2 just came out and I'm very excited to get to that. Stay tuned and listen to a promo from my friend Michael, who hosts the incredibly interesting and unique podcast Murder Mile. It's a cool take on true crime around London, and it's really fascinating. Should keep you entertained until the next episode of Unresolved, at least, which I hope will give us a week's break from murder. Until then, everyone, stay safe, and I will talk to you later.
Hi, I'm Michael, host of the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast, which was nominated as one of the best British true crime podcasts of 2018, is based on my 5-star rated guided walk, and features more than 300 untold, unsolved, and long forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile of London's West End. So if you love hearing about new cases for the first time, old cases through a fresh pair of ears, and classic cases with a twist, all researched using the original declassified police investigation files, written using first-hand accounts, and recorded using authentic sounds from the murder location itself, then Murder Mile is just for you. Download the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast on iTunes, Acast, or your favorite podcast platform every Thursday. Thank you for listening, and stay safe.